Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. Welcome to dialect. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 and also listeners on Unity FM in Birmingham on 93.5 in the Midlands, and not forgetting Radio Verulam in St Albans. This week we'll be discussing props for the main interview. That is not the hip-hop terminology, as in I like to give props to my DJ. That is props as in physical things. We'll be talking to Kate Gerald, who's involved with Mills Antiques. They've supplied to films and restaurants, and Anthea Page has created a feature, which includes Kate, and we have her live in the studio now. Tony Gosling talks to retired journalist and deputy editor of Guardian Weekly, Mike Wren. Also in the studio for another interview, we have Phil, who will be telling us the ups and downs of the coming Bristol Anarchist Book Fair and discussing anarchism. As a precursor to the long-awaited Treasure Island serialisation, we have another part of Robert Louis Stevenson's Letters, read by Alec Milne. Mark Sayers will be standing in as our resident poet, and he'll be reading us one of his poems. And not forgetting, of course, we've always got the What's On guide. Well, I'm John Peters Coleman, and now to start off the show, Bristol holds some magic surprises. Tucked away and almost unknown to the general public is a magical world inside the large brick warehouse of Robert Mills Architectural Antiques. Our intrepid reporter Anthea Page was there to meet Kate Gerald, who took her on a guided tour of the building. Kate will be here in the studio to tell us more about this fascinating collection after this.
Hello, what's your name?
I'm Kate, Kate Gerald. We're in Robert Mills Architectural and Decorative Antiques in Bristol.
I'm absolutely amazed at what I'm seeing here. We're in a room and we are surrounded by huge stained glass windows.
I think it helps that the outside just doesn't let you know what you're going to see when you come inside, does it? It's a very boring, normal 1960s factory on the outside, and I think that really kind of helps when you come in here. 3 metre rose window, they're called, stained glass circular window, and this was actually commissioned for a church in San Francisco about 100 years ago. It was made by the Oatman Studio, which was the studio to Pope Pius the 10th or 11th, I'm pretty shaky on my Pope Piuses, I must admit, but about 120 years old.
It's quite amazing. How did you acquire it then?
We're one of the very few people that deal in Gothic Revival glass, so the dealer that came across this in the States thought of us immediately and contacted us, and we then spent a couple of years reassuring the diocese in the States that we would place it somewhere well and going over there and reclaiming it. So it was quite a long process.
Are you keeping it here now for posterity?
No, it's a commercial piece, so we will sell it. We've sold the other two in the set, and someone will eventually buy it, unfortunately.
So where did the other two go?
I think they both went to wedding chapels in Japan. We do a lot of wedding chapels in Japan.
Oh, how extraordinary.
Yes. And in fact, we heard this week a really lovely story that one of the chapels that we worked on in Fukushima is the only building in its area with water. And so what they're doing is they're using it as a refugee centre. But the stained glass survived the tsunami and the earthquake.
What about the other stained glass pieces?
The rest of them are side windows. It's more difficult for us to place, obviously, pieces like Jesus on the cross. They're not quite as lovely and fluffy as the angels, and they come from churches all up and down the country. Church glass windows tend to last about 100 years. They're leaded together, and then inside there's a cement, which is a mixture of linseed oil and French chalk, and that tends to degrade after about 100 years. If you've ever noticed a leaded like door that's gone a bit wobbly when you close it, that's what happens when the cement disappears. So all these windows would either need restoring or repairing within about 100, you know, after about 100 years. So with redundant buildings, or buildings where, in fact, the parish wants to put in a new set of windows as a dedication to the new vicar, maybe, or someone special to that parish. So these windows were no longer needed.
How old would these be?
These are all going to be around 1880 to 1900.
Take us through some of the other rooms now. We're leaving the stained glass area, which has also got lots of lovely pews.
And a set of Stations of the Cross, as everyone needs a few, and a few pulpits.
Well, there's an organ on the left.
Yeah, I mean, organs are funny. We sell those, again, all over the world. What we find in churches these days is because churches are wanting to be much more spaces that can be used, they need to heat them. And if you heat a building with a lead pipe organ in it, the organ isn't going to last very long. So what we find is people are actually, they're actually using CDs to play the music, and that these are now redundant. So we pull them out and sell them on to people that are going to use them again. We're very pleased that they were exempted from the Lead Act. We were slightly worried that if they were included in the latest Lead Act, that it would be very difficult for us to continue to sell them. I mean, one of the problems with modern health and safety is, of course, these Victorian pieces, that wasn't around then. So if we do want to continue to reuse and recycle, we do have to bear in mind that not all these pieces are up to modern day. But then who's going to go and eat a lead pipe from an organ?
We've just come around the corner at the back of the organ, and Well, organs, there's one, two, three here, and another rose window. Where did that come from?
That came to us via a dealer, actually, so we're not 100% sure where it would have been originally. Looking at the frame, I would assume that has been taken out some time ago and has probably been knocking around and then came to us. We're one of the few dealers that deal in the higher end, more flamboyant pieces. And then we have the Cronolucci here. It's called a Cronolucci, or Crown of Light, which is where that came from.
Is that English?
That's a French piece, actually, although you do get them. But that one, if you can see, I always think that French Gothic is slightly meaner. Their quatrefoils and their arches are just a little bit skinnier and tighter than English.
What sort of people buy your antiques?
We get all sorts of people. People who, we get lovely stories of people that were christened in a certain church or just want a piece of church architecture, right up to putting them back into churches themselves. So it can be all sorts of different people. We deal a lot with people who have a private chapel in their house, so they may want to put them back in again. And then churches all over the world that really love the Church of England English Gothic interior.
What's this here? This is a stone altar.
Stone altar from a school. So this is one piece that we will have to put back into a religious building. Some of the pieces that we get are covenanted in certain ways. They can't leave the country. They have to go to a religious building, etc. And this is a covenanted piece. So as a domestic customer, you wouldn't be able to buy this unless you were putting it back somewhere that was on consecrated land. We do find with a lot of the Gothic pieces, they weren't just made, it was part of the communion that people were doing while they were making them. So they're usually of a higher standard than other antiques of the same period. So I would say they're always a good buy because they were the best workmen that they could get hold of.
Going through another doorway now into a panelled room. Linen fold panelled room.
Yeah. The linen fold denotes originally, to stop being so cold in a room, people would have literally hung linen on the walls. And this panelling is harking back to that. And that's why it's got a wavy look to it, or linen fold.
Can you talk to us about the fireplace? This is a magnificent piece of carving. What wood is it?
It's English oak, which is very unusual. We reckon that the English oak would have run out really by in between the First and Second War, and that's why you see a lot of other oak coming in that you can date pieces, because they're what we would call American light oak, whereas this is English brown oak. Beautiful colour, beautiful wood. But of course, we have now pretty much run out of it. So if you want an entire English oak panelled room, you are going to have to buy an original one. And this has got the entire carving of the family crest on it. Quite an impressive piece. I mean, this was your blinging. This was how you showed off that you had made it back in the Victorian era. This is the Bentley of its era kind of thing.
So do you know the history of this panelling, where it came from?
We do. We know the house and the family that this piece came from. And we believe that it originally started in their Tudor building. And in fact, when they struck it big, they then built themselves a Victorian pile, and this piece was taken there. You can actually see an expansion piece at the end piece there, that there was an extra piece of panelling made, because when it was moved, the room was slightly different size. The original house was knocked down, and then the Victorian house, unfortunately, has been split into flats now. So no, it was Staffordshire, somewhere around there.
So we're now moving into the bar area.
Well, yes, and we've got 5 or 6 different bars and bar back set up. I mean, one of the things that obviously England or Great Britain is famed for is its antique Victorian pub interior. And so we export those all over the world. We have bars coming from, you know, the States, Sweden, everywhere, coming and buying these pieces.
Well, we're standing in front of a really magnificent
glass one, this.
It's etched glass, mahogany, a real Victorian sort of thing you might find in a Degas painting.
Yes, we call it a gin palace. Yeah, there's a gin palace look. There are several looks within in older pubs. We have what we call the Irish grocer look. You know, the idea that in Ireland, pubs were quite often shops, so very plain and quite simple. And this would be what we would call the gin palace. So we've got all the etched glass, the mahogany, and yeah, it was again, a real statement piece.
And what's that hanging from the ceiling? It's like a lighthouse lantern.
Yes, it's a Moroccan light, actually. You can see the Moroccan symbol at the top, the half moon.
We're going round the corner now.
In the loading bay, where items arrive and depart. So, in fact, the heart of the business in some ways, and the most chaotic bit of the business. But right in front of us, we've got a set of bronze doors from a bank in Birmingham, actually. They're very much in the classical style. You can see the element in the late Georgian period where they were taking these classical elements, Palladium style. Not something that we work with a lot, but they are a stunning set of doors. We have a larger stone altar with its niches, and in fact this one has the Corpus Christi and Mary and Joseph with it. Beautifully carved.
Is this the one on our left?
It is, yeah. And you can see the Corpus Christi over there. Almost life-size, actually. Corpus Christi, the body of Christ. So quite often you'll see him crucified, and that's... obviously quite a look you see a lot in churches. And then the piece is finished off with carved finials at the top, and it's niched. It's a niche holder for statues, carvings of saints. So again, quite a Catholic piece.
So what's through here? Oh, now, on my left here is an absolutely amazing piece of carving.
It's a chancel screen. That's a chancel screen.
What would separate...
That one's oak. So again, beautiful, beautiful piece. Would have separated the chancel from the main body of the church. Not so common these days. I mean, in fact, Henry VIII ripped a lot of them out to begin with, and that was part of the Reformation. So they're not hugely common, and certainly not in this scale. I think the last one we sold went to a chap who was dividing his music room, to give you an idea of scale of his house. And in fact, we had to wait for him to take the roof off to be able to fit it in.
And which church did this come from?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't know that one. So
is it a bit sad that some of these pieces go abroad?
No, for several reasons. Firstly, the reasons that these pieces are coming out of churches in the first place is that the Victorians went in, and I would suggest that they gave us our idea of a modern church, but they did go in and, you could say, vandalised. They went in and reordered their churches 100 years ago, which is why we have this idea of a church being a very Victorian interior. What our vicars are saying to us now is, it's all very well and lovely having these beautiful antique pieces in, but you have to keep the air, the temperature at a stable temperature, so you can't heat it on a Sunday when you want it to be warm or when you want your toddler group in. And you also have to keep the building locked a lot of the time because these pieces are valuable. So the churches then don't become churches, they become museums of ecclesiastical pieces. The other thing the churches say to us is, if they want to have a toddler group or a yoga group, they can't have pews in there because they can't physically move them about. And pews were designed by the Victorians to be uncomfortable because there was a lot of hell and damnation back in Victorian era towards churches. Vicars are saying to us now, I don't want to be in a pulpit 6 feet in the air, I want to be part of my communion. And so a lot of the pieces that came in Victorian churches are now quite outdated. So no, I don't think it's sad to say that these pieces are coming out. We do have to sell them, unfortunately, though, in order to give the church some money for them in the first place and continue to reclaim them. We started this business because my stepfather was driving past a church where they had taken these wooden pieces out and were just burning them. So we've got two choices, really. We either landfill them or burn them, or we reuse them. So we would feel, you know, in reclamation, the mantra always is, if it can be reused, let's reuse it. You know, it's a beautiful thing. It hasn't finished its life yet.
Well, I heard Anthea Page talking to Kate Gerald about the amazing artefacts inside the Robert Mills Architectural Antiques Warehouse here in Bristol. And we have Kate here in the studio now. Hello.
Hi.
So tell me a little bit about Mills Antiques. Obviously, you might have said some in the feature there, which people might have said, but for people who have no idea where it is.
Well, we're down in Eastville, and most people don't really know the difference between antiques and architectural antiques. So what we sell is the kind of architectural components of the inside of buildings. So columns, doors, windows, stained glass. And we're particularly well known for our Gothic Revival and Ecclesiastical. So the insides of when churches reorder and modernise, because a lot of churches these days want to have yoga classes, etc. So they need the space in there. Mm. We take out the pews, and then we upcycle them and turn them into pews for people's houses, but all sorts of other things as well.
All right, OK. So not antiques as in Lovejoy and Tinker.
No, very unlovejoy. Right? I don't drive a Volvo, no.
Out of curiosity, what leaps immediately into my head, there is a climbing centre in St. Werburgh's that used to be a church.
Yeah,
did
there is.
Did you have
is.
Anything to do with taking any of the old stuff out of there?
No, we didn't. No, we didn't. But my daughter did use it when she was younger. It was a very lovely place.
Okay. Are you finding quite a lot of churches are increasingly sort of being turned over to normal domestic use now? So presumably that must be a major source of...
Funnily, no. That's what a lot of people think. But actually, no. I mean, obviously, recently with the recession, no, things haven't been moving so quickly. Hmm. But what we find at the moment... Most churches were reordered, as we call it, or refitted about 100 years ago. The Victorians went through a lot of churches and ripped the interiors out and put new Gothic Revival pieces in.
Yeah.
And they've come to the end of their lifespan about now. A lot of vicars are saying to us they would rather have a church that was actually part of their community and evolved along with every other building around there.
Rather than looking ancient and out of date.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Vicars don't want to these days stand 3 foot in the air and shout brimstone and fire at people. They actually want to be part of their congregation. And pews are in situ. You can't move them about. Mm. And so if you want to hold a yoga class or you want to put a bathroom in or a toilet in or things like that, you can't do it with the pews. Also, these Victorian items need to be kept at a static temperature. So in a lot of churches which are heated a few hours here and a few hours there, it actually damages and rots these pieces away. And what they want is to be able to take them out, put in central heating and have a much cleaner new environment to carry on with today's work.
Okay. Do you ever get any collectors of this stuff for their own sort of private interest?
Gothic nuts, you mean? Yes, yeah. Yes, we do. All sorts of people. I mean, Bono has fitted out two castles with items, some of them from our place. But so, you know, it goes from Bono right down to, I've got pews in my house. I've got religious statues. So you don't have to be a millionaire to own this stuff.
Yeah. What are the main sort of reasons that people will come to you then?
All sorts of things, actually. Some people come to us because they have a love of good architecture and beautiful things. Other people come to us because it's a practical and fairly cheap way of getting hold of something that's going to last a lifetime.
Right. But it must be a fairly massive place to house all of this stuff.
Yeah, it's 30,000 square feet. You've got to have a lot of headroom to have a 5-metre chancel screen in place.
Right. And is there a lot of money in it particularly? I mean, do you get much of a turnover out of this?
I mean, like anybody in this kind of thing, you don't do it for the money. I actually left a normal everyday occupation. This is a family business, and I came in about 6-7 years ago, and we work long hours, but it's a passion. It's something that you do for love. So yeah, I'm not going to lie, I make a reasonable living, but no, I'm not finding things that I'm sending to Christie's for £1 million every week.
Okay, is there anywhere like this, sort of in the southwest? Do you know?
Funnily, the southwest particularly is a hotspot for architectural reclamation, and Bristol is a real hotspot. There are loads of yards. There's Marcus Olive in St Werburgh's, there's Wessex in St Werburgh, there's Rose Green Tiles in Eastville, lots and lots of yards in Bristol. You'd be surprised.
Right, okay. What sort of relationship do you have with film and television then? Presumably they must come to you quite a lot.
They do, and it's interesting. I mean, this is a really good example of why we are cheaper. The film companies come to us because it's cheaper to hire or buy something from us than it is to go out and manufacture it today. So that's how we started getting involved. We've done everything from the Da Vinci Codes, Harry Potter's, St Trinian's. We're working on Madonna's film. We had Madonna's interior designer on the phone hassling us to get some panelling recently to recreate one of the palaces.
Right. Okay, so what sort of happened? Do they already have sort of ready-made plans? They, you know, sort of say, right, well, this is our shopping list, and, you know, you just sort of cruise about with the giant trolley.
Yeah, basically. Well, quite often right. They'll email us or fax us or ring us and try and explain the scheme. So, for example, Doctor Who wandered in recently, and that was quite a clear one because I know what the TARDIS looks like. So, unfortunately, we couldn't help.
That's a hell of a thing. Doctor Who came to my shop recently.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I'm a real Trekkie. So, for me, unfortunately, the historical period dramas, Bleak House and things like that we've worked on, although they're lovely and they're very interesting, yeah, it's the Doctor Who's that get me every time.
So how did you sort of come across this? Did you start this yourself or...?
It was my stepfather, actually, 30-odd years ago, driving past a church in Cottam. The other thing that's interesting about reclamation in general is you can't landfill wood. So the whole industry started because people were driving past places like churches that were being reordered anyway and finding that the builders were burning the stuff. So my stepfather started dragging it home, like lots of people did back, you know, 30-odd years ago. Mm. Skip raiding on a grand scale, it must have been. Yeah. And we got to about the third garage before my mum said, look, you know, this is getting crazy. If you're using this stuff. He was using it to fix a boat that he wanted some good seasoned timber.
Yeah.
Other people are going to want it too. So, and that's how it started. Back 30 years ago, it was really raw material. So it was woodblock flooring, roof joists, things like that. And obviously the market has evolved on as people have realised that there's some really beautiful things coming out.
What sort of domestic, ordinary applications does a lot of this stuff have? I mean, if someone has their mock Jacobean house and they fancy some giant Corinthian pillars outside their front door to accompany the BMW, can they...
We really have had a certain mega-rich footballer pop star combo contacting us to buy certain items. Unfortunately, their family crest has only recently been made, so we couldn't find 100-year-old Bibles with their family crest on.
Right.
But, you know, you've got a table, I'm sure, in your house. You know, yeah. We sell workaday tables. What's different about the stock that we sell is that these items were made to be fixed and repaired and continue on, whereas the stuff that we buy nowadays is meant to be thrown away in 3 or 4 years. So, in fact, it's not only a beautiful thing to have in your home, it's a really good way of saving the planet, and you can do it very easily.
Okay, so there's a certain good environmental aspect to this that you could really use to...
Definitely, definitely. And I think that's why the likes of people like Jamie Oliver, who are starting to use more and more reclamation in their interiors, are starting to realise that not only do you get a much better product than you'd be able to buy today, an oak table, 100 years old, has built up all its patina, it's beautiful. You can't buy that today. And you shouldn't be buying that today. We shouldn't be buying things like teak that are unsustainable.
So in a way, we should be seeing more and more, you know, sort of reclaimed old furniture on TV, irrespective of, you know, whether it's a gothic drama or not, to try and encourage people to buy more of this.
Exactly,
stuff.
Yeah. And the best thing to do, I mean, don't come and buy stuff from us. Just keep hold of stuff. First of all, reduce what you're using and then come and reuse before we even think of recycling. Recycling is quite often taking our beautiful wooden things and pulping them up to turn them into MDF. So we would much rather say, when you buy something, buy it to last. Don't think you're going to throw it out in 3 years when you change your wallpaper. And then if you are going to have to buy new, buy something that's going to be sustainable and long term.
How do you sort of financially estimate what something is worth when it's coming in? That's got a bit of an elusive art, hasn't it?
Well, you know, there's the age old, it's worth what someone will pay for it. Well, so, you know, it comes down to that. And there is scarcity value, et cetera, et cetera. But really, for example, we have a £35,000 stained glass window, beautiful 3-metre rose window that we salvaged from San Francisco. Now, if you went out today and had that made, it would cost you £60,000, £70,000. £5,000. So although these things appear to be relatively expensive...
So people contact you, sorry to interrupt, but from all over the world, by the sounds of it.
We sell a lot, yeah. Japan is one of our major stained glass places. It's a very fast-growing Christian population in Japan. They like to be married in English wedding chapels.
Oh, so like to buy it and transport it over there.
We had a really lovely story about Fukushima. One of the chapels that we work with over there turned out to be the only building in its area that had water still, and so they carried on using it. And we had an email within 24 hours from this customer saying not only is the building still up and the water's running, but the stained glass survived it as well. So it was a really lovely thing to hear.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. OK. So, I mean, what sort of interaction with other local premises and shops do you have in your area? I mean, a lot of places in Bristol are all about trying to buy local, and at least you don't get any competition from Tesco's, I suppose.
No, exactly. And again, one of the things that's really strong about the reclamation trade is we have always had to use local restorers. So whilst now it's fashionable to lime plaster your house, et cetera, we've been having to use those skills for 30-odd years, and we've been keeping those alive. And one of the things that the reclamation trade is very keen to do at the moment, and we're pushing the government to do, is to set up a lot more apprenticeships so we get people back into doing those traditional skills. We have to accept that if we're going to have those traditional skills, people are going to have to pay a little bit more for the things that they get.
Yeah.
But if you buy longer term and better quality, then you don't have to buy so many.
And in terms of longer term and better quality, is it worth looking at any of these as a financial investment at all, do you think?
It's always a bit worrying to think of things as a financial investment. I mean, our mantra is very much buy things that you love because you love them and they make you smile. If you get up and smile at that table every time you set it for the next 15, 20, 30 years, you know, you're saving your money that way, aren't you? But yes, intrinsically, they will retain their value to a certain extent. And at the moment, as the American market is very depressed, what we call brown furniture, tables, chairs, your average workaday Victorian furniture is incredibly good value.
So
I can
send
you a dresser for the same price as you can walk into a high street shop and buy, and you're buying a piece of history.
So the depression could possibly have been quite good for you in a way.
I think the recession is always has always been a good thing. If you look at the 80s recession, that's where the reclamation industry really started.
Mm.
And in fact, what people do in a recession, especially this very strange one where a lot of people have ended up actually not being I know this is going to sound very arrogant, but most people have said are actually financially okay. They're worried about the future, but they're okay. They're thinking about, if I'm going to spend money, I'm going to spend it on something that's going to last and be there in the future, not a 5 minute.
Are you online?
We are, www.rmills.co.uk.
R Mills.
R Mills. Robert Mills is the company name.
rmills.co.uk.
And we're on Twitter, Facebook, etc.
Oh, you're on Twitter as well.
Oh,
people
yeah.
keep up with your latest reclamations.
It's a
mixture of gothic
hour industry.
And 21st century technology. Amazing. Whereabouts in Eastville are you, if people want to?
We're on Narrowways Road, just behind the Chinese supermarket.
Kate Gerald, thank you very much.
Been a pleasure.
And now to discuss anarchism and an upcoming book fair, I'd like to introduce Phil. Hello.
Hello.
So I suppose the first question is, are you an anarchist?
Yes, I am. I am.
Okay, so you're a qualified person to talk on this subject. So where are you based? Are you squatting or...?
No, I used to. I live up in Easton.
Okay. And how are you involved in the... we've got an anarchist book club or premises, which is currently based on Stokes Croft, I notice, opposite the Free Shop and the Emporium.
Yeah,
for anybody who knows that area, are you involved in that?
Yeah, I know that place. I'm vaguely involved. I know the people who run it. But my main thing's organising the book fair, which is... same separate event.
Okay. Well, we'll come up to that in a little bit, but just give people a flavour of anarchism, really. I mean, to a lot of people, that basically just sort of means you're really into complete disorganisation as a principle. Is that a miscomprehension?
Yeah, it is a bit. Anarchy literally means without authority. And by that, we mean a society where people aren't told what to do, but they choose to cooperate voluntarily. So in political life, they don't have the state telling them what to do. Economically, they're not told what to do by a boss, but cooperate with their workers to run business. And we're against oppression in social life, against sexism and racism. So it's not really that there's no organisation, it's just that there's no authority. So it's very different to what people might think. Anarchy is chaos, but it's not chaos. It's,
right, okay. So it's possible for you to have a relatively organised annual general meeting with that?
Yeah. We have lots of meetings. We organise a lot. So.
Okay. So tell me a bit about the book fair and what you want to achieve with this.
Okay, so it's a day-long event. It's the fourth year we've done it. Obviously, there's lots of books there. There's about 50 stalls, mostly independent, small publishers with books on political, social, historical subjects from an anarchist perspective. As well as that, there's a whole programme of meetings through the day on all sorts of subjects. We will be getting that programme together over the next week. We've been taking submissions from loads of different organisations. And, yeah, it's a great day to network with people, to find out what's going on in Bristol.
Okay. I mean, presumably you've had a lot of chance to make a lot of capital out of the cuts and the depression. Have you noticed an increased uptake in interest in the last couple of years as opposed to the first year that you did it?
Yeah, I think we have. It's grown every year. It's now over twice the size of the first year we did it. And there's a lot more people getting involved and getting political. These cuts are really affecting people's lives, and they want to try and make a change.
Okay. I mean, I suppose anarchism in general, a lot of people would say, well, we've got to have some kind of an authority, and to what extent are the state really telling me what to do as such? I mean, I just have my job and my life, and I'm quite happy. And anarchism sounds a bit over the top. Like, how would you, if you had sort of 30 seconds to sort of state your advert and say, this is why you should really come along to this book fair, even if you're not sure? Like, you know, what are you going to say, really?
I don't think people really get to choose the politicians they want. Labour and Conservatives are well to the right of most people's political views. And that's because we have a capitalist system that puts the state in place to protect the rich. And we want to do away with that, and also do away with all the inequality and privilege in society, because that's what underpins the state as we have it, and that's the reason for it.
Yeah. So what sort of pedigree of literature are you going to be having? I mean, anarchism as a principle sort of goes back to the 19th century, at least. So, I mean, are you sort of going to have a grand array of literature all about all the general facets of anarchism, and all the various different sorts, I suppose, as well, because they're not necessarily...
There is a huge variety of stuff we'll have there. Yeah, some of it will deal with historical stuff, like the Russian Revolution and the Spanish Civil War, but loads of it is about contemporary issues, about struggles going on today.
Some people at the moment might judge anarchism as being associated with the people who are on the recent relatively, or planned to be relatively peaceful, anti-cuts march that took place in London, turned it into a sort of a bit of a violent farce. Are you or your fellow anarchists like supportive of sort of the violence that took place on that march by anarchists, or do you sort of distance yourself from that?
I wouldn't condemn people for doing that. I think people are very angry. I think they made their point well, that they were targeting their violence specifically against the rich. It wasn't mindless. It was very well chosen, I think. I don't necessarily think that's the best way to go around things, but I think it's really understandable that people are that angry.
That's fair enough. Okay, well, I mean, we haven't got time, unfortunately, to really discuss things in depth as perhaps either of us would like, maybe, but what is the date of the book fair?
Yes, it's on the 7th of May, Saturday the 7th of May. Starts at 10:30, going on till 6:30.
Okay, and this is at Hamilton House, which is the canteen, a.k.a. the canteen, on Stokescroft in Bristol.
That's right.
Brilliant. So if any of that struck you as curious and you simply want to find out more, then go along. Phil Pope, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So just to reiterate, it's free entry. There are workshops and stalls. It's accessible to everybody. And there is a vegan cafe and the Indymedia room too at that event. And if you want to find out more, you can always check the website, www.bristolanarchistbookfair.com. Mike Wren is a retired journalist who lives in Bristol. His profession has changed massively over the years, with huge old printing presses and hot metal giving way to word processors and desktop publishing. In the 1970s, Manchester was a national newspaper hub.
The Manchester Press had a reputation as a very hard drinking place. That was one of the reasons why it was a career in the press was generally frowned on by respectable people. I mean, in Manchester, there were clubs, I say the word clubs in inverted commas, there were basically drinking dens that were open to members of the press up until 3-4 in the morning. There were so many journos and printers and compositors hanging about at that time that they had to, obviously, there was a great need of refreshment, and there were plenty of people who were kept open late in order to satisfy the thirsts of the newspaper workers, which were considerable. Yeah, there were quite a few nippings off to pubs and clubs. In fact, this sounds bizarre, but my father worked on the press at the Daily Mail, the great rotary presses, and the system there was, because the working conditions were so unpleasant, people were allowed to bring drink into work. and they would work half an hour on, and because the noise and conditions and the heat and that were so awful, they were then allowed to repair to the table in the press room and sink a couple of pints and then go back onto the press. I mean, to our minds, this just sounds ludicrous. It's so dangerous. Because by the end of the night, you want people rolling around these press rooms with these great things thundering away, and they're half cut. But this was the way people behaved in those days, and it was normal to consume a great deal of drink, and it wasn't regarded as anything particularly unusual. Of course, drink was fairly cheap. I became, at a fairly early stage, the deputy editor of The Guardian Weekly. The Guardian Weekly was basically a cut-down version of the best stories that were in The Guardian, and it was assembled once a week, and it was distributed worldwide. I mean, I remember one night, when just before press, this wasn't in the daily paper, and I remember Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands, and we were fairly pushed to get that paper out at that time, with the invasion of the Falkland Islands on the front page. That did take some fairly speedy subbing, I can remember that.
Now, in those days, of course, it was the whole thing was... actually, you included this thing called Stop Press. I can remember seeing, you know, there was actually a blank bit left on the newspaper, yeah, so that the presses could actually, if there's a really important story came along, presses could be halted.
This was...
And a new story added in that section.
Yeah, there was even a method where you didn't even stop the press, and it was called the fudge box. The fudge box was a slot at the edge of the page one where you could actually put stories in, like late racing results or football results or some snippet of, you know, some court case. And it was actually bolted onto this part of the... press while the thing was running. It sounds lethal, but it was actually, and you didn't actually have to stop the press, and you could take this news mid run. It sounds bizarre, but it was a feature of press in those days. Particularly the more popular papers would run with a fudge box and take these late stories while the press was actually running.
Now, you mentioned briefly the union. Do you think there's really any point in being part of the National Union of Journalists?
Yes, I do. I think it's great to have a representative body of people in the trade or profession. And it's a way of keeping people in touch, people of my age, with keeping in touch with younger people. And you need a body that will represent your interests, but in the workplace, in the sphere of pay and conditions, and also as in the sphere of professional standards. So yes, I mean, you know, I'm sure the National Union of Journalists will continue long into the future. It doesn't mean to say I agree with everything it does, but I think overall, more power to its elbow.
Has it actually made a difference in your career at all, the union?
It certainly did when I started, because for a while I was father of the chapel. Basically, it's a shop steward. The chapel is newspaper workplace meetings were known as chapels from the days of the Methodist chapels, and it had certain religious overtones. And when I was father of the chapel in Stockport, we negotiated the first house agreement in with the Thompson Group, and that brought us a decent increase in salaries at that time. And then when I joined The Guardian, The Guardian Chapel in Manchester was very active, and I remember going on strike there once for the same pay and conditions of we wanted parity with the Manchester Evening News. Can you imagine that? They were better paid than we were. Having said that, the compositors and the press people in those days were paid far more than journalists, because they were better organised.
So have you noticed much of a difference over the years between different newspaper groups and how it is for the union to deal with the different newspaper groups and how they treat their workers?
My experience latterly has been with the Northcliffe group, which was only dragged kicking and screaming into recognition of the NUJ in Bristol, at its Bristol office, 5 years ago? Yeah, it's about 5 years ago when we achieved that. And certainly when redundancy became a big issue, it was extremely useful to have the backing of NUJ people, and the people who came to help us from the London office were of pretty high quality and knew what they were talking about. I mean, that was useful. You don't feel so alone then. I felt that was very well worthwhile.
Have you got any advice for young people thinking of entering the profession today?
Oh, dear me. I certainly don't envy the task they have, because it's far more difficult to get in, and because of the immense amount of competition, the salaries are, generally speaking, extremely poor. I mean, the salaries that people were being taken on for at the Northcliffe in Bristol were more or less identical to what they were paying 20 years before. So I suppose if I had any advice, it would be keep in touch with the changes in the media world, and make sure that you stay abreast of the changes which seem to be coming faster and faster. And good luck to you. I mean, I've had an interesting and rewarding career. I doubt today I'd even be considered for a job in the media. But such are the changing times that confront us.
Retired journalist Mike Wren there, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. Thank you to them both. The 18-monthly conference of the National Union of Journalists is taking place in Southport this weekend. Check out their blog on the internet via www.nuj.org.uk. We are assured Treasure Island, the serialisation, complete with sound effects, is coming up. It's in due course, it's in production, and it's read by Malcolm Grieve, and it'll be winging its way to us soon. But to prepare us for that, as ever, we have Alec Milne reading the 13th part of The Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest McHugh. The music you hear accompanying this is Duff, performed by Concerto Caledonia.
For the last 4 years of his life, Stevenson made his home on his estate in Vailima, nearly 600 feet above sea level, in the hills, about 3 miles inland from Apia, the chief town and port of Apolu, the most important of the three principal islands comprising Samoa. Arvalis and Fanny reached Apia from Sydney on 15 September 1890 and moved into Vailima. During their absence, H.G. Moore had arranged for a small cottage to be built on the estate for the Stevensons to live in, pending the planning and construction of a larger house. Here they lived for the first 5 months, under the most primitive conditions. A valuable record of how they looked to an outside observer, albeit a prejudiced and snobbish one, is provided by the letters written by Henry Adams, a distinguished American historian, who, with his companion John Lafarge, paid his first visit to Vailima on the afternoon of 16th of October. At last we came out in a clearing, dotted with burned stumps, exactly like a clearing in our backwoods. In the middle stood a two-storey Irish shanty with steps outside to the upper floor and a galvanised iron roof. A pervasive atmosphere of dirt seemed to hang around it, and the squalor like a railroad navvy's board hut. As we reached the steps, a figure came out that I cannot do justice to. Imagine a man so thin and emaciated that he looked like a bundle of sticks in a bag, with a head and eyes morbidly intelligent and restless. He was costumed in a very dirty, striped cotton pyjamas, the baggy legs tucked into coarse knit woollen stockings, one of which was bright brown in colour, the other a purplish dark tone. With him was a woman who retired for a moment into the house to reappear a moment afterwards, probably in some change of costume. But as far as I could see, the change could have consisted only in putting shoes on her bare feet. She wore the usual missionary nightgown, which was no cleaner than her husband's shirt and drawers, but she admitted the stockings. Her complexion and eyes were very dark and strong, like a half-breed Mexican. When conversation further began, though I could not forget the dirt and discomfort, I found Stevenson extremely entertaining. In another letter he described Arliss and Fanny as looking like queer birds. He never seems to rest, but perches like a parrot on every available projection, jumping from one to another and talking incessantly. The parrot was very dirty and ill-clothed, as we saw, and being caught, perhaps, unawares, and the female was in rather worse trim than the male. By April 1890 the new house had been built, and they were able to move in, after a fashion. In May, in a letter to his Aunt Jane, Arliss summarised what he had been achieved. "When I look back on this place which Fanny and I came to some 8 months back, and found a trackless forest, some clearings, houses, stables, paths, and food trees everywhere rising, I am surprised at our success. It was a tough job, and Fanny had the heavy end of it." Lloyd had already returned from England, where he had arranged for the packing and dispatch to Samoa of the furniture and household effects from Skerryvore. The Vailima household was complete. In reading Stevenson's letters from Samoa, it has to be remembered that they took about a month to reach Britain. The mail steamers of the Oceanic line, plying between San Francisco and Sydney via Honolulu and Auckland, made a monthly delivery and collection of mailbags in Samoa. Henry James, 29th December 1890, Vailima. "My dear Henry James, it is terrible how little everybody writes, and how much of that little disappears in the capacious maw of the post office. Many letters, both from and to me, I know have been lost in transit. My eye is on the Sydney post office, a large, ungainly structure with a tower, as being not 100 miles from the scene of disappearance. But then, I have no proof. The tragic muse you announced to me in coming, I had already ordered from the Sydney bookseller. About 2 months ago he advised me that his copy was in the post, and I am still tragically museless. News, news, news. What do you know of yours? What do you care for mine? We are in the midst of the rainy season, and dwell amongst the alarms of hurricanes, in a very unsafe little two-storied wooden box 650 feet above and 3 miles from the sea beach. Behind us, till the other slopes of the island, desert forest, peaks and loud torrents. In front, green slopes to the sea, some 50 miles of which we dominate. We see the ships as they go out and in to the dangerous roadstead of Apia, and if they lie far out, we can even see their topmasts while they are at anchor. Of sounds of men beyond those of our own labours, there reach us very long intervals, salutes from the warships in the harbour, the bell of the cathedral church, the low of the conch shell calling the labour boys on the German plantations. Yesterday, which was Sunday, we had a visitor, Baker of Tonga. Heard you ever of him? He is a great man here. He is accused of theft, rape, judicial murder, private poisoning, abortion, misappropriation of public monies, oddly enough not forgery nor arson. You would be amused if you knew how thick the accusations fly in the South Sea world. Kipling is by far the most promising young man who has appeared since, I appeared. He amazes me by his precocity and various endowment, but he alarms me by his copiousness and haste. He should shield his fire with both hands and draw up all his strength and sweetness in one ball. So the critics have been saying to me, but I was never capable of, and surely never guilty of, such a debauch of production. At this rate his works will soon fill the habitable globe, and surely he was armed for better conflicts than these succinct sketches and flying leaves of verse. I look on, I admire, I rejoice for myself, But in a kind of ambition we all have for our tongue and literature, I am wounded. If I had this man's fertility and courage, it seems to me I could leave a pyramid. Well, we begin to be old fogies now, and it was high time something rose to take our places. Certainly Kipling has the gifts. The fairy godmothers were all tipsy at his christening. What will we do with them? I'm going to manage to send a long letter every month to Colvin, which I dare say, if it is ever of the least interest, he will let you see. My wife has had an abscess in her ear, but she is now better, and I hope will be reasonably right. We are a very crazy couple to lead so rough a life, but we manage excellently. She is handy and inventive, and I have one quality. I don't grumble. The nearest I came was the other day when I had finished dinner. I thought a while, then had my horse saddled, rode down to Apia, and dined again. I must say with unblunted appetite. That is my best excuse. Goodbye, my dear James. Find an hour to write to us and register your letter. Yours affectionately, RLS.
Many thanks to Alec Milne there for reading us one of Robert Louis Stevenson's letters. It's my pleasure to welcome a new face, or should I say a new voice, to the Dialect Studio for a poem. Mark Sayers, hello.
Hello.
Usually, obviously, we have Trevor Carter or Tim Burrows in, but it's our pleasure to introduce a new voice. So how do you come to know Trevor and Tim?
Well, I belong to various poetry groups, and that's where I meet them.
Okay. Whereabouts in Bristol do you live?
I live in Clifton Village.
Right. So what is your sort of relationship with poetry like? Because it's been a sort of a lifelong thing?
No, I've been writing poetry for about 25 years, I suppose. But most of the poetry I've written has been in the last 7 years.
Right.
And I came to Bristol 5 years ago.
Mm. What turned you on to poetry sort of at such a late stage?
Well, I suppose in a way, when I came down here, my wife and I had separated, and so there was a sort of gap in my life, and poetry filled it. That and going to the pub.
Yeah.
And then I started, you know, noticing things, and that's how I started writing poetry.
Have you often had a fondness for literature and reading generally sort of throughout your life?
Not really, no. When I look back, I hadn't the faintest interest in poetry.
Right. Do you take any more interest in reading other people's poetry now, or do you just tend to focus on your own?
I don't read enough of other people's poetry, I'll be quite frank.
Because you're too busy writing?
I do write quite a lot, and I find I'm always amending it because it's never quite right.
Yeah. Well, some famous poets have been the same, so you might be in good company. What is your sort of style of poetry? What do you like to write about, sort of people or places or a whole random range of stuff?
I think it's mostly about my own experiences and about people that I come across, and just general things, like, you know, if you bump into an anarchist, then that's quite a good opportunity to write a poem about anarchists. You know what I mean? It's just anything that grabs you, really.
Okay, well, what poem have you got for us today?
Well, I live very close to Clifton Suspension Bridge, so you can't help admiring Brunel.
Mm.
And this is a poem called Bristol's Adopted Son.
Okay.
It's just as well we've got Brunel, for his bridge has true lineage. Not only that, we love his hat, the way he stands looking offhand. You can walk on Bristol's icon, free of charge, which beats the Taj. Wrought iron forged across the gorge, his necklace hangs. No sharabangs, and for a start it's built for carts, horses and folk, without the yoke of all those cars, some from afar. Ere he espied his child, he died. Brunel went spare about Queen's Square, for he had planned, you understand, a fine station in that location, though costs were high, he'd not deny. Yet his creation won citations at Temple Mead, where all took heed as buildings, train sheds went ahead. A people's palace for Bert and Alice. Knitten or spitten, we're all smitten by the Great Britain and its hard-bitten designer, for we've seen none finer to grace our shores. Yet he adored to puff cigars from Panama, sip café noir in the bazaar, wolf froggy food and could be rude, for he's half French, which is a wrench. Taken with tunnels, propellers, funnels and railway trains, he had such brains. Those great iron ships which could outstrip sail, paddle, wheels and a march steel on all that went before. There's more. His railway lines could cut the time for travel and thus help unravel the country's map so that the gap to London town now cause few frowns, since Jill and Harry needn't tarry, but took the nippers, John and Pippa. In his age, Brunel was the rage.
Thank you. That was excellent. Are you? Do you have anything published? Do you like to see your works in print?
Only with poetry groups I go to. They've published a book down in Weston-super-Mare and one in Wells and one in Bristol, but nothing of my own. I haven't gone okay. into that yet.
Well, I hope we hear some more of your poetry soon on this show again, but thank you for coming in.
Not at all. Thank you.
Unfortunately, we don't have Jeff for a couple of weeks, but he's hoping to be back with us shortly. In the meantime, we have Michaela's What's On with a twist.
Indeed, and the twist is it's not Jeff. So first up, we have we have Under Oath and Deaf Havana at the Beer Keller on Tuesday the 12th of April at 7:30, and the tickets for that are £14.25 in advance. We've got table seats at the Hoochie Coochie Cabaret for Vaudeville Night, which I can definitely recommend, that are still available on the Thursday the 14th of April. That's being held at the Metropolis in Stokescroft. Doors are at 7 and tickets are £16.50 in advance. Or for something completely different, on the same night you could try the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra and the BSO Chorus at Colston Hall. So that's Thursday the 14th again. That starts at 7:30. There are a range of ticket prices, about £13 to £23. But if you're under 26, you can get a ticket for £8. And even better, if you're under 18, you can get a ticket for £1, which I think is pretty amazing. And finally, on the Sunday the 17th of April at the Thunderbolt, from midday right through to 11:30 at night, in aid of Japan, the Tsunami Appeal, there's a big event going on there. Earlier on the day, it's poets and acoustic acts and bands later on. There'll be a barbecue and a CD being made of the whole event as well. And if you want to find out more about that particular event, it's £4 for a ticket. You can email bassbuzz, which is BASSBUZZ, at hotmail.com. Now let me present the song of the week. This band have recently released a new album, The King of Limbs, but this is a track from their 97 album, OK Computer, and it's No Surprises.
No surprises.
That was Radiohead there with No Surprises from the album OK Computer. For more information about the band, you can visit radiohead.com. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but we have some fantastic theatre going on in Bristol. Tobacco Factory's Shakespeare at the Tobacco Factory season is continuing from Richard II to The Comedy of Errors, and that's running until the 30th of April, with performances starting at 7:30 daily. There are also Saturday matinees, and tickets there start at £12. That's the Tobacco Factory in Southville. And also at the smaller Brewery Theatre, which is just opposite the Tobacco Factory, there's a staging of After the Accident, which is a drama about the idea of restorative justice, and that's after a hit and run. So serious stuff, but the play is on until the 16th of April. Tickets are £9 and £7 for concessions if you fancy that. And finally, just a bit of a heads up, the programme for Mayfest, which is the Bristol area's experimental theatre festival, have been announced kind of a week or so ago. So to take a look at the programme and start ordering tickets, you can take a look at www.mayfestbristol.co.uk. I'm sure it'll be just an exciting, ambitious programme as it was last year, so I definitely recommend taking a look at that. So that's all from me this week. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much. Don't forget, of course, we've got the Bristol Folk Festival coming on at Colston Hall, which is now run no longer by Bristol City Council. It's been handed over to the people who work there. So that's good. That's really interesting. The Bristol Folk Festival, of course, is sort of like an outdoor festival, complete with fake grass and portaloos and tents and all sorts of stuff, but indoors, inside the Colston Hall. And somewhere in our copious back catalogue of shows, I did interview the woman who founded the Bristol Folk Festival. Well, that's all from Dialogue for this week. Our studio guests were Kate Gerald and Phil. Features were by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling. We had a letter read by Alec Milne and Mark Sayers, treated us to a poem. The studio engineer was Michael Noyce, and the producer was Michaela Dennis. And myself is John Peters Collin. Thank you very much. Goodbye. I got a hopscotch to jump, I need to jump, I got a hopscotch.